So 1 year ago today, we kicked off our generosity initiative across all eight Atlanta area churches, and we're calling it Deeper Wider. And the goal, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, and as most of you know by now, is to maximize our impact locally, locally, nationally, and globally. And when you leave today, you're going to receive one of these. We handed one out. Oops, I walked up without it, and that's my fault. Lots of changes today. Anyway, you're going to get a vision guide, and we handed one of these out a year ago. This is a brand new one, newer pictures and updates for everything that's going on. So one per family. We'd love for you to pick one of these up. If you're watching online, if you'll just go to deeperwider.com. And let me say to our online audience, so many of you who don't even live in the Atlanta area have participated financially in this. We are so extraordinarily grateful. And I know one of the reasons you do is because you're saying, we need a church like your church in our city. And I want you to know we're doing our best to be on the way, and your generosity is helping us do that. A quick reminder, if you've been around for a while, or if you've been around, and then this is new information if you're new, what we've accomplished together over these 30 years is really remarkable. Eight Atlanta area churches, large churches, about 70,000 people involved, 213 or so network churches around the country and around the world that impact, this is amazing, or that involve over 600,000 people. And the amazing thing, and again, the part of one of the reasons we're doing this is so many good things have been going on, and we never talk about it on Sunday because we've got to get to the songs and the sermons, and you're busy, and we got all this programming going on locally. So last year at this time, we started talking about it. And up until last spring, anything that we did nationally or globally, we paid for with what I call, this isn't a great phrase, we paid for it with margin money. At first I was gonna say leftover money, but there's no leftover money, right? Margin money. And what this means is any money that we didn't use locally on campuses, we use to expand our influence, again, nationally and globally. And the way it works is you give to your local church, and again, we take the money that we don't use on the local campus and invest it in some of these national and global initiatives. And while we've done a lot, and up until last spring, we had done a lot, we realized internally there was a lot more we could do if we decided to. So I'm like, well, why don't I just tell all of our churches what we're doing, because they don't know, and it's our fault, it's not your fault. So I asked last year at this time, I said, hey, do you wanna do this? Do you wanna maximize our impact locally, nationally, and globally? And if you wanna do it, it's gonna require us to leverage our collective financial capacity. We can't maximize our influence if we just use the margin money. And the reason I ask this question, and this is so important, is not because your church needs your money. It's because the world needs your influence. The world and local communities in this country as well need more churches like the church that you're sitting in. And what do I mean by that? I mean outward facing churches. Churches that are focused on people who are far from God, people who feel like they've had such a bad church experience that can't ever come back to the church. Churches where the rungs on the ladder start about halfway up. And if you're starting a faith journey or restarting a faith journey, you can't get on the ladder. There needs to be more churches like that nationally and all over the world, outward facing churches. And when I asked, do you want to do this? This was amazing. About 5,500 households out of all of our Atlanta area churches said, yes, we're in. We want to do this. And you filled out a commitment card. We don't ever do that. I think this is the first time we've ever done something like that since we started the church. Oh, the commitment card, you turned it in. Some of you, I get this, were commitment card resistant. Like, I feel like if I commit, then it's like I have a debt. So you didn't fill out a card, but you increased your giving. Some of you began giving to a church for the first time. You'd never given to a local church before for a variety of reasons. I've heard them all. I understand that. Anyway, and then as a part of that, we set a really big goal. In fact, we when I looked at the number, I thought, we can't present that. It's overwhelming, and I don't like to lose, so it's easier if you just drop the goal so you can. Anyway, I know. Anyway, that's a personality thing. Anyway, so we set a really big goal based on actual opportunities. As we looked at all the opportunities and asked, what would it cost to really go big on this? And so our goal was to raise $100 million over 2 years in addition to our regular giving. And then we would invest or spend that money over a five-year period into these different initiatives. And so the additional money combined with our normal giving would go into one of these three buckets. And we talked about this. This is all review, but if you're new, we're glad you're hearing all this. Three buckets: transformation, expansion, and innovation. Transformation is essentially all the stuff that we have been doing anyway, what we're currently doing, what you and your family experience on a weekly basis. Expansion is simply more of that in more places. That is multiplying those experiences nationally and multiplying these experiences that you experience on a Sunday morning internationally. And then innovation, there are some things that we want to do that have, there's some things we want to try that have never been done before. And one of them in particular is really expensive. And we thought, you know what, if we're going to do this, let's let people know what we're doing to see if they want to get involved. So again, the goal was to raise $100 million additional dollars. And as of today, you, all of our Atlanta area churches have committed, and those of you online have committed a little over $99 million. So that's not how much has come in. I don't want to be confuse you. But in terms of the commitments, we almost have almost $100 million committed above what normally comes into our Atlanta area churches, which is absolutely amazing. And of course, many of you over this past year, you started giving, fulfilling your commitments or giving for the first time. So we got busy spending and investing that money. And if you've been attending for a while or watching for a while, you'll know that we've given you updates all along the way. It was so important to us that you know where the money's going and you know how that money is being invested. So we've shown you video updates. If you're on our email list, we send out email updates. We want you to know here's the progress that's being made because of your extraordinary generosity. You'll hear more about this one later, but just real quick, in this past fall, Sandra and I went to Auckland, New Zealand, halfway around the world, and then Sydney, Australia, and Brisbane, Australia. And we met with about a little over 500 church leaders from several hundred different churches, some of whom are already our partners. And what happens is we go into a city, we promote that we're gonna be there, and our partner churches invite all their pastor friends that they think would be interested, and we kind of do show and tell. This is our model. This is what we're trying to do. This is what it looks like to be an outward-facing church. And our partners halfway around the world, or really all over the world now, are replicating the model church that you experience week in and week out, and the same environments. In fact, there's a church, well, there's in Perth and in both cities in Australia. We walk in, and when I was in Monterrey, Mexico a couple of years ago, I walk in and there's Womboland and there's Upstreet and they got all of our stuff on the wall and they're using our curriculum and they're translating it. And they're just so thrilled that somebody has given them a model that allows them no longer to be an insider-focused church, to be an outsider-focused church. Then and this coming July, we have a Latin American network that's so amazing. And part of that network are countries in South America that don't speak Spanish, Brazil in particular. So in July, we have one Brazilian here, that's exciting. Go Portuguese. So in July, we're going to officially create a second network. So the Latin American network, there'll be a Spanish-speaking and Portuguese-speaking one based out of Brazil. And our host, Tiago, launched Red Church. He launched a church in his garage. He's an extraordinary leader. And here's the thing I love about what we're doing. We attract very entrepreneurial church leaders. And the problem is, and the reason this is so important, is denominations, I'm not against denominations and generally don't attract entrepreneurial leaders, they attract pastors. And I'm all for pastors. I are one. I'm not a great one, but I'm a better preacher than I am a pastor. But anyway, so what happens is educational systems oftentimes and church systems oftentimes don't give permission for leaders to lead. We are attracting leaders, and you know this about leaders. You don't have to tell them how. You just tell them what, and they just need a picture, and then they go figure it out. So we're attracting that kind of leader. So anyway, Tiago in Brazil, that kind of leader, starts a church in his garage, grows it to about 300, and then almost 500. Then he came and found out about us, spent some time with us. We talked about the model. He went back to Brazil, grew his church from about 500 back down to about 150. And then it exploded. He embraced what you're doing. They started building a building. They was having a hard time raising money. So even before last March, we wrote them a big check and said, finish your building. So in July, they're gonna do a conference, show and tell for that whole part of the world. We're gonna go down there and do the conference with them in their brand new building that you helped complete. Look at this. This is what you did. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. From his garage. Because why? Because he's a leader. He just needed permission. He just needed a model, and he just needed a little wind in his sails. So those are the kinds of people that we're attracting and have been for many, many years. So locally, on the local side, we begin facility and technology upgrades. You're going to see and experience some of that. Nationally, we're a full court press trying to find more and more entrepreneurial leaders in this country that want to be a part of this network, and enlisting them, entrepreneurial leaders who, again, they just need permission, they just need a model, they just need to know they're not crazy because they're trying new and interesting things. This past week, this was so much fun, I went to Richmond, Virginia, and I spent a day with over 100 African-American church leaders from the state of Virginia, from 50 different churches. And we have an extraordinary partner there in Richmond, and he and his influence invited all of his African-American pastor friends and saying, hey, we can do this. Our state needs to do this. It was absolutely incredible. Then in May, and I'm going to get into the sermon in a minute. I just got to tell you. But I just want you to know what you're doing. It's just so amazing. So in May, we're going to host our very first Irresistible Church conference. We've been doing a conference for years, kind of show and tell for anybody that wants to show up. So we've shut that down. It was called Drive. So our joke is we parked Drive. Anyway, so we're going to do this conference, and this is just going to be for our network partners from all over the country, all over the world, and we're saying we want you to invite one or two pastors or churches from your area to participate so they can see what we're doing and to decide if they want to be a part of it. You can't just join this network. We vet these people. We test them. We look at their websites. We make sure they are serious about being outward facing, and are they willing to make the change is necessary to be that kind of church. Now, if you're new, quick bit of history. Our church is 30 years old. 30 years ago, I met with a much smaller group of people, and I asked them to give financially to an experiment. And that experiment became the church that you're seated in today. And that initial group of people are so grateful that they said yes to that invitation. Because when they show up at any of our buildings and see what we're doing all over the country and all over the world, here's what they think. They're like, wow, I had a part of that. I was there at the beginning when it was purely experiment. In fact, we've been told what we're trying to do won't work in the Southeast because everybody in the Southeast knows what a church is and they go to church and they have expectations and they're going to think you're a cult, which there was some of that as well. Anyway, so here's the thing. Four years from now, as we can invest this money over the next 4 years, 4 years from now, there are going to be thousands of men, women, and children and students who will be grateful for you because you said yes. Now, to the sermon part of this. As I was thinking about just what we've experienced the last year, it dawned on me that I think launching deeper, wider was an inflection point for our entire network of churches, our Atlanta area churches. An inflection point, it was originally a mathematical term, but now it's used in business. It's used when people are talking about the economy. And an inflection point is used to indicate a moment in time or sometimes a season that marks the start or the acceleration of something. And it can be either positive, it can be for the better or for the worse, that it marks the beginning of significant change. And you don't know if an inflection point is happening when it's happening. You generally look back and go, oh, that's when things changed. Oh, that's when things turned for better or for worse. They're rarely obvious in the moment. It's like the first domino that falls, but you don't recognize that was the first domino that fell. Other terms to describe this are a turning point or a tipping point or a watershed moment or a flash point. And looking back, what's interesting, and I don't want you to daydream while I'm preaching, but this may send you off in daydream world. Looking back, we can, almost all of us can recognize these kind of turning points or inflection points in our personal lives. Any decision that you made or any decision that was made about you that altered your future would be an inflection point. my first date with Sandra, as I was thinking about this, I was tempted to say that first date was an inflection point, but there was actually something else that happened on our first date. And I've shared the whole story with some of you, so I won't go into the details, although they're interesting. She was very quiet. So I was just filling out, just talk. You know, I was kind of nervous. And in those initial conversations in our car, driving, we were going to go meet some of my friends. And I asked her a question, and she told me a story about a decision she made that demonstrated extraordinary character and the ability to deal with pressure, the ability to maintain her values under pressure. And when I look back, I think after that story, I was a goner. It was a done deal. I think that's when I fell in love with her. Anyway, the point is, all of us have things we can look back on. Another illustration, 30 years ago, when I met with a group of people about starting this church, and I said this, I said, hey, just so you know, Atlanta doesn't need another church. I mean, there are so many churches in Atlanta. I said, Atlanta needs another kind of church. And when I said that, something happened with that group of people. Something began, and there was no stopping it. Another example that some of you may be more familiar with, 20 years ago, which I can't believe was that long ago. I double checked this morning. 20 years ago, I preached a series of sermons. I mean, a series of sermons. You know, we do series all the time. And I named it How to Be Rich. And so I preached this series, How to Be Rich, in 1 Timothy 6, you know, the verse we use for the Be Rich campaign. And as a result of that sermon series, it got our church to thinking, wait a minute, that's bigger than a sermon. That's bigger than a sermon series. It got us to rethink our whole approach to generosity and had us ask the question, what would real generosity look like in our communities around our churches? And something happened in our churches. And ever since then, and well, actually a couple of years after that, as that idea began to grow and grow and grow, that was an inflection point in our whole approach to being generous to our communities. And as you know, since then, you have given over $100 million to community nonprofits. So there was something happened. Now, when I preached the series, I'm like, that's just another series, right? But something happened. And looking back, it impacted our approach to generosity. In fact, one of the things I love about you is last year when we launched the Deeper Wider initiative, I heard from several people, and I love this. You know, there are things people complain about. It's like, really? And then there are things people complain about. It's like, oh, you get it. There are good things to complain about. And so I heard from several people, Andy, I know we're doing this Deeper Wider thing. We're not gonna stop doing Be Rich, are we? I love that. It's like, hey, whoa, but we're not doing this instead. I'm like, no, we're gonna try to, I know it's crazy, we're gonna try to raise an extra $100 million and give away $8 million a year. It's amazing because you're amazing. Anyway, I said, no, of course we're gonna keep doing Be Rich. This is part of who we are. Anyway, love that. So then the Bible nerd part of me started thinking about this whole inflection point, and I thought, I wonder what the inflection point was during Jesus' public ministry that his disciples didn't recognize as an inflection point in the moment. But later, after the resurrection, they looked back on their experience with Jesus and they went like, we should have known. When that happened, I mean, that was the first, they didn't have dominoes, right? But that was the first, we should have known. Something happened then, and after that event, there was no turning back. Nothing would ever be the same. To borrow a phrase from Julius Caesar, who lived about 80 years before Jesus, when he decided, and some of you are familiar with this point of history, when he decided to cross the Rubicon with his army, knowing that it would trigger, or it could potentially trigger a civil war in Rome, which in fact it did, looking back, his phrase was the die was cast, that referring to a singular dice. In other words, the outcome was inevitable. Fate was in motion. There was no turning back. There was no way to stop this thing. So my opinion, this is what I want to talk about for just a minute. Just my opinion. What I think, I think the inflection point in the public ministry of Jesus was when Jesus was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane. And here's why I think that. And we've talked about this before, and if you know the New Testament, you know this story. Toward the end of his ministry, he tells his disciples, we're going to Jerusalem. They're like, that's a bad idea, okay? I mean, anytime you get close to the hub, things don't go well for you or us. He's like, no, we're going to Jerusalem. We're gonna celebrate Passover in Jerusalem. And they get the sense that, okay, this is the culmination of everything we've been waiting for. And on their way to Jerusalem, Jesus warns them. He tells them over and over, okay, when we get there, your worst nightmare is going to become a reality. I'm going to be arrested. I'm going to be mistreated. I'm going to be manhandled. It is not going to go well with me. And if you're too close to me, it's not going to go well with you. And for whatever reason, and I think we can kind of imagine it, they just couldn't hear that. They just didn't accept it. They just wouldn't hear it. I mean, all this talk of turn the other cheek and love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you and blessed are the weak and blessed are the meek and blessed are the... I think they were like, okay, that's just talk, okay? He was just playing along, you know, getting people to follow us. But eventually, he's got to step up and be the Messiah. He's got to step up and be the king. And now we're going to Jerusalem at Passover. And Passover is the best time to take over. So when they go into Jerusalem, there's these crowds of people welcoming Jesus, welcoming the king into the capital city. And they are like, this is the day we have been waiting for. Then they get in the city and there's all this drama and there's spies and he teaches at the temple. Then he leaves the city and he teaches and he leaves. And there's so much going on, so much drama. And then the time for the Passover meal comes along and they don't even know where they're gonna celebrate it because Jesus kept it a secret from them because it's like there's so much mystery. And finally he says, okay, it's time for us to celebrate Passover, follow me. And they walk through the streets, you know, of Jerusalem. They go to a place they'd never been before that's called an upper room. It's up a second level of a house of somebody who loaned them the house. And they have this Passover meal. There's so much drama. Jesus says all kind of things that just didn't make any sense in that conversation. And then he said this. He said, you guys are gonna abandon me, which meant there was gonna be conflict. And they're like, hey, when it comes to a fight, we are willing to die for you. They're thinking it's about to happen. Then they finish the meal. They leave the upper room and they walk through the dark streets and alleys. They're like, where are we going? He doesn't say. And they end up in a private garden, the Garden of Gethsemane. And when they get there, there's nobody there. It's like, no plot to hatch. And then Jesus says the strangest thing. He says, have a seat and I'm gonna go over there by myself and pray. And they're thinking, I mean, I'm thinking, they're thinking, pray? You've been praying for 3 years, okay? Enough praying. We need to plan. I mean, if this is gonna happen, there are things we need to do. And where is Judas, by the way? Maybe he's working on it, right? We'll pick it up right there. Here's Matthew's account. It's so amazing. Then he returned. Jesus returned. He's praying by himself. He comes back to the disciples. You all remember this if you grew up in church. And he said to them, are you asleep? He's already woken them up once. Are you still sleeping and resting? I'm over here praying. And they're like, they're zonked out, you know. Look, he says, this is important. He says, look, or behold, the hour has come. Now, this is important because on multiple occasions, the crowds of people tried to proclaim Jesus king, and he would say, my hour has not come. My time has not come. On a couple of occasions, the high priest had people out to try to arrest Jesus, and they couldn't get to him. And Jesus would say, my hour has not come. The time has not come. But now he's announcing the time has come. And they're thinking, good, it's about time that the time has come. We thought the time was never going to come. And then he burst their bubble. He just undermines all of their expectations. He says, the hour has come and the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. And they're thinking, wait, what? Delivered? We thought you were going to be the deliverer, not the deliveree. Okay, we thought you had come to deliver us from Rome. What do you mean you're going to be delivered? And while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, shows back up, but not the way they expected. And with him was a large crowd. So there's Jesus and 11 apostles. There's 12 of them. Judas shows up with a large crowd, dozens, armed with swords and clubs, visible, sent from the chief priest and the elders to arrest Jesus, because Judas said, hey, I can get him separated from the crowd. And they paid Judas to betray Jesus. And going at once to Jesus, it's such so much drama. Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, greetings, Rabbi. And he kissed him. And here's why he kissed him. It's pitch black dark in a garden. And he said, the sign, the one you are to arrest, don't try to take the whole group. If you just take the one, this movement dies instantly. The man I kiss, that's the guy you want. And he kissed Jesus. And then Jesus pulls back and he replies, friend? Now, interesting Greek word. It's not the warm, affectionate word, friend, like friendly. The word is heteros. And it's simply, it's like if you're out on the street and you see somebody who's not looking at you and you don't know who they are, but you need their attention for something, like they dropped their wallet or maybe something fell out of her purse. You would just say, friend, excuse me, friend. It's not personal. This is the term that Jesus uses. It's not warm, personal term. And then Jesus, there's so much drama. Jesus lets on that he knows what's going on. He says, Judas, do what you came for. Do what you came for. And the 11 with Jesus are stunned. It's like, wait. You're just gonna let them take you? Wait, you brought us here knowing this was gonna happen, away from the crowd, away from our protection. You brought us here in the dark knowing that you were gonna be delivered into the hands of a betrayer and the henchmen from the temple. You're just gonna let them take you and no fight? You're not even gonna try to get away, no fight, no flight, no fight, no flight. Peter, remember, Peter tries to fight and Jesus just shuts him down. And then Jesus is so powerful when you read it. And then Jesus, who is still, this is so amazing, Jesus, who's still very much in charge of the situation, never loses his cool, if we could say it that way. And Jesus, he reprimands the mob who came to arrest him. He doesn't fight, he doesn't run away, he just reprimands them. He says, seriously, am I leading a rebellion? Seriously, that you have to come with swords and clubs to capture me? I mean, isn't this a bit overkill? Have you ever seen me with a weapon? Have you ever seen my men armed? I mean, you got one guy with a sword. We put that away quick, right? I mean, why are you here with weapons? I mean, this is way overkill. Have you ever seen me armed? No. Every day, I mean, just shames him. Every day, since he got to Jerusalem for Passover, he's been there a week. Every day for the past week, I've been in the temple courts in public teaching. And you didn't try to arrest me. And I think he paused to let that sink in. You didn't try to arrest me when you could, because you're afraid. It would have been easy. You're afraid. That's why you came at night, armed. Implication, y'all are just a bunch of cowards. But this is amazing. But this thing you are doing, this thing where you think you are in control, this thing where you think you're controlling outcomes, this thing where you think you're controlling history, you think my destiny is in your hands? No. This thing that you're doing, look at this, has all taken place that the writings of the prophets might be fulfilled. This was predicted long ago. And then all the disciples, the 11 that were with Jesus, they chose one of the only two options available. One of the only two options they thought was available. They couldn't fight, so they chose flight. And all of them deserted Jesus and fled. And Jesus chose neither. He delivered himself into the hands of his enemies. He surrendered his life to sinners. And that, I believe, was the inflection point. Because unbeknownst to anyone in that moment, It set into motion a series of events that could not and would not be reversed. And in this moment, it punctuated once and for all time, that the kingdom of Jesus was a kingdom nothing like the kingdoms of this world. That he was a king like no other king. That he was not the king that demanded his servants give their lives for him. He actually came to give his life for them. His kingdom was not of this world, but it was certainly for this world. And in that moment, again, he was the king like no other king. And I think, well, not only think, we know this is true. After the resurrection, when they're all gathered together and this whole thing is over and they're just, their minds are just blown because of what they've experienced. After the resurrection, it clicked for them that in fact, just as Jesus had said, the kingdom of God had come to earth and everybody was invited. Everybody was invited to participate in it. So, what does all of that have to do with all of us? Here's what it has to do with all of us. This is why what you're doing is so important. Jesus' decision set off a series of events that have touched every single generation since then, including ours. And that generational impact, that multi-generational impact continued. Do you know why it continued from generation to generation to generation? Because of people just like you who have answered the call to do for others what God through Christ has done for you, what God through Christ has done for all of us, locally, nationally, and globally, that you are funding an expanding network. You're funding an expanding network of churches, but not just any kind of church. The kinds of churches that are committed to the kingdom teaching of Jesus and on earth as it is in heaven kind of church. And on earth as it is in heaven approach to faith or version of our faith. Faith that has feet, faith that does something. Faith that actually cares about communities and cares about people in communities who don't care about us, people who are far from God, who don't believe in God, because we believe God loves everybody, whether they love God back or not. That kind of church, that kind of faith, that kind of active faith, doers, not just believers. And the truth is, we've been doing that for years locally. And a year ago, we caught a glimpse of what could be, and I think should be, and through your generosity, that is becoming a reality. So, wrap this up. On behalf of thousands, I love this. On behalf of thousands, not just in our church, but all over the country, on behalf of thousands of middle schoolers who are developing a faith of their own, thank you. And on behalf of thousands of high school students who are learning how to live that faith out at school and eventually throughout their lives, thank you. And on behalf of this is amazing to me, over 600,000 men and women and children and students who are part of our network of churches, thank you. On behalf of Tiago in Brazil, thank you. On behalf of Roberto in Monterrey, Mexico, thank you. And you know, on behalf of Perko, my friend in Perko in Australia, who runs our Australian network, he would say, thank you. Duncan in the UK and Jamie in Ireland and Paul in South Africa. And last but not least, and I'm gonna close with this, I wanna say thank you on behalf of John and Ashley McNary and Heartland Church in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. He wrote me a letter, and I'm just gonna read it to you real quick, because I just want you to know what you're doing, that it's a big deal. And it's not just a big deal to us. It's a big deal to a lot of people you'll never meet. Here's what he said. Andy, I wanted to take a moment and write you to let you know what an incredible blessing it has been for our church to be part of the Irresistible Church Network. He's been a part of it for several years. My wife, Ashley, and I, along with a wonderful small group of people, started Heartland Church in Madison, Wisconsin, back in 2007. At the time, we were 25 years old and had never led a church before. All we knew was that this community needed a church that would welcome people from all walks of life, a place, I love this, a place where people could belong before they believed. And while we kept seeing God change people's lives, we also took some friendly fire from people who thought we might be a little bit too welcoming. Because we were not part of a church planting network or a large denomination, we felt very much like an island. And we frequently ask ourselves, are we allowed to do church like this? And honestly, we didn't know the answer. There were so many times over those first 10 years that we prayed for some sort of connection with other like-minded churches. And ICN, the Irresistible Church Network, has been an answer to that prayer. Through the network, we've become connected to so many other incredible churches and church leaders. We have benefited from the resources, the ideas, the shared best practices, and these connections have inspired us to double down on our commitment to being, I love this, to being an outward-facing church that loves people first and works out the details second. That is what Jesus did. Follow Jesus through the Gospels, and that's what he did over and over and over. The woman at the well, he starts a conversation, and I shouldn't get off on this. He starts a conversation with a woman at the well. Some of you know the story. He says, look, before we go too far, I just want you to know, I know you've been married 4 times before and you're living with a guy. I just want you to know I know that. Now let's talk. It's like, whoa. You're talking to me and you know about my mess, because I thought if he knew me, he wouldn't talk to me, and you already know me and you're talking to me. Well, yeah, we can work that out later. I love that. Honestly, I can't imagine how we would have navigated the last 6 years without this network. And today we are outgrowing our newly built building, and we're getting ready to launch our first multi-site location. We also just hosted all the other Irresistible Church Network churches from Wisconsin for a one-day gathering, and it was a huge success. I feel incredibly grateful, not only to you and your team, but also to the people in your church. Because while they may never know us personally, they have invested in me, our church, and our community all the way up here in Wisconsin, and that investment is paying eternal dividends. Meanwhile, we just get up, try to get our kids dressed, try to get us dressed, get our coffee, come to church, consume the sermons. And all over this country, people are impacted by what you do. And we're gonna pick it up right there next week in part 2 of this series, Inflection Point. Before you go though, one more reminder, make sure you pick this up. In the front, you're gonna find a commitment card, an updated commitment card. And if you're new, you don't know anything about this, it's your first time to find out about it, the good news is it's not too late to participate. And you can just check this top box right there. It says, I would like to make a 1-year commitment. Last year we made 2-year commitments, but this is a 2-year campaign. So if you're new, that's your opportunity. If you turned it in last year, this is important to us as well. We'd love for you to confirm your commitment. And here's why. Things change for people financially through the year. Some of you made commitments that's like, oh no, something's changed, lost a job, you know, something didn't happen and you can't make the commitment. We understand that. And you don't even need to let us know. But if you are gonna fulfill your commitment, this helps us plan. For others of you, you've already fulfilled your commitment and you're thinking, I could do more. And if you can do more, and if you'll do more, we will be extraordinarily good stewards with your more. And you can let us know that you're planning to increase your commitment. Last thing is this, March the 22nd, I guess 3 weeks, we're gonna have another service where people turn in their cards. And if you normally watch online, but you live in the Atlanta area, we would love for you to be at one of our churches on March 22nd. Last year when we did this, it was a very special day in the life of our church. We hate for you to miss that. If you have any questions about any of this, the easiest place to get your questions answered is right here at deeperwider.com, deeperwider.com. Thank you for what you've done. Thank you for what you will do. And thank you on behalf of tens of thousands of people who are being directly influenced by your generosity and your participation in one of our churches. I'll pray for us and we'll take off. Father, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Nobody's mind is more blown than mine. Father, you know how humbled and overwhelmed All of this is to Sandra and to me, and to so many of us who were here 30 years ago when this was just an idea. We want to get it right as you'll let us get it. So guide us, direct us, motivate us, inspire us, and I pray that we would be instruments in your hand so that it's true that the kingdom of God will be more present on earth than it's ever been before. And we pray all of that in Jesus' name. Amen.